Blog Talk Radio. Black masses, evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death construction, in the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning, death and hatred to mankind. Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord,
yeah. darkness world stops turning. Ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power. And as God has struck the hour, day of judgment, God is calling. On the knees of war pigs crawling, begging mercies for the sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh Lord Jesus.
Back in the day of Black Sabbath. Well, wow. That was back in the day, wasn't it, kids? All of you youngins out there listening to this shit, you know, come on, man. You know, that's when rock was rock. Rock is no more. It's gone. It's goodbye. Goodbye. Anyway. Anyway, you know, it's Thursday, 2023. Fuck, where did 19 come from? Them days have been over, youngins. It's been over for a long time. 23 years, exactly. God damn. Wow. Ain't that crazy? Wow, time flies. Wow, got to see everything from the record to the tape to the 8-track to, you know, wow, cassettes, CDs. The CDs are still around. Everything's going MP3. You know, everything's going digital. Digital recording. Why do we need tape or any substance? We just see a little square cube thing plugging in. God damn, it's raining this ass. That's a lot of thunder. Okay. But anyway, we're going to go into a clip. Dr. Carlson says, who should be afraid of? Who ain't we afraid of? Fuck, come on, man. We don't know who's who anymore. So here we go.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. There is a verdict in that very depressing but also Byzantine and interesting murder trial in South Carolina tonight. We've got Judge Jeanine in a moment to take us through exactly what happened and what happens next. But first, you always imagine in your mind's eye that it's evil men who destroy society, wild-eyed, spit-flecked dictators pounding the podium to demand the annihilation of their enemies. That's the Hollywood version of it. But in real life, people like that rarely get very far. They're too obvious. It's not the cartoon demons you've got to worry about. It's weak men in positions of power. They're the most dangerous. Men with no principles but the desire for self-preservation. Hollow men who live in terror of being revealed for who they really are. Men who will do anything to save themselves. That's who you should be afraid of. And you can see that in our current moment. The weakest are the most destructive. How much of his childhood do you think Adam Kinzinger spent hanging from the wedgie nail? How many swirlies did Eric Swalwell endure in high school? How old was Adam Schiff before a girl other than his sister kissed him voluntarily? It makes you shudder to think about it. These are sad, insecure, broken men filled with envy and bitterness from their lonely childhoods. They hate you because they hate themselves. It's not their masculinity that's toxic. It's their lack of it. That's really the story of the Biden administration. The weakest president in history joined forces with the weakest attorney general in history to create a police state. Shocking? Well, once you understand the principle, it shouldn't really surprise you. And it's funny now to remember that the smart people in Washington once told us that Merrick Garland was a moderate. They thought that apparently because when Garland's promised Supreme Court seat didn't materialize, he cried. Oh, he's crying, they thought. He's so sensitive and thoughtful. But no. Merrick Garland was crying for himself because he is a self-pitying careerist with no perspectives on his own life whose job is everything to him. He is, in other words, literally the last person you would ever put in charge of the Department of Justice. So naturally, Joe Biden did. And that turned out to be a pivotal decision. Merrick Garland has presided over the most aggressive attack on civil liberties, and in particular, an attack on the practice of traditional Christianity any living American has seen. Now, Garland would never say that in public, of course. That would be too straightforward. His approach is feline, not canine. Every word is a weasel word. But under sustained questioning, the real Merrick Garland emerges, and it is filthy and dishonest. Here he was in the Senate yesterday facing off against Mike Lee of Utah.
DOJ has announced charges against 34 individuals for blocking access to or vandalizing abortion clinics. And there have been over 81 reported attacks on pregnancy centers, 130 attacks on Catholic churches since the leak of the Dobbs decision, and only two individuals have been charged. So how do you explain this disparity?
We apply the law equally. I will say you are quite right. There are many more prosecutions with respect to the blocking of the abortion centers. But that is generally because they are those actions are taken in, with photography at the time during the daylight, and seeing the person who did it is quite easy. Those who are attacking the pregnancy resources centers, which is a horrid thing to do, are doing this at night in the dark.
Okay. In case you didn't follow that, we, quote, apply the law equally. We just can't for some reason manage to investigate crimes that occur after dark. It's the sundown rule, well known in legal circles. It's hard to believe that Merrick Garland actually said that in a Senate hearing until you remember that, of course, he will say anything, and he does. We're not persecuting Christians, he'll tell you. Then he'll send the FBI after Mark Houck. Houck is a pro-life lay preacher who was praying outside an abortion clinic when a pro-abortion extremist harassed his 12-year-old son. So as any father would, Houck shoved the man out of his son's face. That's what happened. It was not a crime. We know that because the local prosecutor pursued it. And it is certainly, without question, not a federal felony to push a lunatic out of your 12-year-old son's face. But under Merrick Garland, it is now a felony. Almost a year after that happened, Garland sent armed men to arrest Mark Houck in front of his family.
On September 23rd, about 6:45 in the morning, that's when those 20 so-called agents, full SWAT gear, heavily armored vests, ballistic shields, helmets, battering ram, banged on my door.
Yesterday, Josh Hawley asked Garland to explain that behavior, the utterly indefensible totalitarian behavior. And Merrick Garland, of course, in his soft-spoken way, was delighted to defend it.
Let's take a look at the hardened criminals that your Justice Department sent these armed agents to go terrorize on that morning. Here they are. Here they are at mass. Here's the seven children.
with Mr. Houck and his wife. He has offered to turn himself in. And this is who you go to terrorize. You are the Attorney General. Give me your answer. Do you think that it was objectively reasonable and they followed your guidelines in sending 20 to 30 armed agents to terrorize these people? Yes or no?
The facts I have, which are those presented by the FBI, are not consistent with your description.
So you think it was reasonable?
I'm saying the facts are not as you describe.
You use an unbelievable show of force with guns that I just note liberals usually decry. We're supposed to hate long guns and assault-style weapons. You're happy to deploy them against Catholics and innocent children.
He doesn't care. He's got no soul, obviously. And if anything, Josh Hawley's description is too narrow. It's not just Catholics that Merrick Garland has targeted with force. It's anybody who expresses a belief in biblical Christianity in public. But it is true that Catholics do seem to be getting a disproportionate share of federal law enforcement attention under Joe Biden. The FBI, as you may know, just drafted a memo claiming that radical traditional Catholics are somehow a national security threat, presumably because they tend to pray outside of abortion clinics. In March of 2021, Paul Vaughn and 10 others were peacefully praying at an abortion clinic in Tennessee. They didn't damage any property. They hurt no one. More than a year after they dared to do that, to pray, Merrick Garland sent the FBI to terrorize Vaughn and his 11 children at their home.
But if you're not going to let me, then I'll just...
No, I want to know why you were banging on my door with a gun.
Hey, let's go back to that.
You're not going to tell me anything?
No,
they're
not.
I tried.
Man. No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
You did not try.
You have to wonder when you see a tape like that, where are so-called Christian leaders? Where's Russell Moore and all the other breastfeeding Christians as that happens, as the U.S. government cracks down on Christianity, on prayer? Silent. Paul Vaughn and his co-conspirators now face more than a decade in prison. Meanwhile, just in case you want to know what the scale is for punishment, the Department of Justice under Joe Biden let half the rioters go who tried to torch a courthouse in Oregon. No charges whatsoever. Of 99 cases that the Portland U.S. Attorney brought over that courthouse siege for crimes like assaulting federal officers and civil disorder, more than 47 were dropped by DOJ. The most serious penalties for most of the defendants who pleaded guilty turned out to be community service. So the DOJ under Merrick Garland absolves Joe Biden voters of actual terrorism while doing everything they can to terrify, humiliate, and destroy people who pray in public. They're targeting specifically anyone who is religious, humiliating them in front of their children. Now, why are they doing this? Well, because on some level, all governments hate religious people because it's competition. And revolutionary governments, totalitarian governments, go after religious people first. It happened in the French Revolution, happened in the Bolshevik Revolution, and it's happening now. That's why parents who dare to complain about their children being sexually indoctrinated and openly sexualized are attacked, in some cases, by the DOJ. Again, you can see why. Young people raised to believe that God is in charge are much harder for the government to control as they grow up. They won't worship the government. But, by contrast, if a child is raised to be a narcissist, someone who thinks I change my gender, he will grow up confused, weak, and reliant on the people in charge of the state. It's a very simple principle. It's why the Maoist government went after Tibetan monks. Anyone who sincerely believes in God is a threat, and that is the measure of a free country in the end. Are you allowed to believe that there's an authority higher than the people in charge of your government? That has always been the hallmark of America, religious liberty. It's in the First Amendment. But in Canada, of course, that's all disappeared. Canada has now become an atheist totalitarian state with amazing speed. And in Canada, it's now a crime to object to sexualized drag shows for children. You're not allowed to say a word. Late last month, a pastor in Calgary was violently thrown out of an all-ages, Mothers for Children, drag queen story hour for daring to object to the sexualization of children. Watch this.
Coming. Either it is your choice to leave or deal with the police.
So that's the video. That's what happened. Who committed the violence in that video? The guy on the ground was the pastor. Before we answer the question, some context will remind you that in Canada, showing any disloyalty at all to the Trudeau government could get your bank account frozen and your truck seized. So maybe you're not surprised to learn that that man on the ground, whose name is Pastor Derek Reamer, who showed profound disrespect for Justin Trudeau's ongoing efforts to sexualize children and mutilate the genitals of children, woke up yesterday to the police banging on his door and telling him he was going to be arrested.
Why are you showing up at my home?
Because this is where you live, right?
Yeah, you guys could call me. We could.
Sorry, what was that?
You could have called me.
I've been trying to.
When?
Before. We need to talk about what happened on the weekend this evening, right?
Why do we need to talk about it?
Because you're going to be arrested for it and charged.
Okay.
So we can go deal with it this morning, or I can just put warrants out for you.
Charged with what?
Mischief and causing disturbance.
Where are all the professional Christians? You have to wonder that again. Where's David French and Beth Moore and Tim Keller and all these people who are defending Christianity as actual Christians are being arrested for being Christians? Not a word. Well, today, Pastor Derek Reamer confirmed that a warrant was out for his arrest for hate crimes, and he was right about that. He was not overstating it because this afternoon, he was literally arrested. Why?
Is there a reason you're blocking me from using the sidewalk?
Construction, they're working here.
I'm not going to shock them. Don't worry, I'm not going to run.
I'm not worried about you. We're going to stay out of the workplace.
Can I ask you what he's being arrested for?
You can provide your identification.
Pardon?
Will you provide your ID?
For you to answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay. Why is he being arrested?
He has warrants.
Warrants out for his arrest?
This is what happens when we go against the Drake.
Wow! That doesn't look like the Canada you thought you knew. All Molson and sled dogs or some stormtrooper in sunglasses won't answer a question before you provide your ID. And then the pastor sitting in a car with bars on the windows getting hauled away to jail for being thrown to the ground at Drag Queen Story Hour. Subscribe to the Fox News YouTube channel to catch our nightly opens, stories that are changing the world and changing.
You okay? You okay? You okay, Daddy? You've been hit by, you've been struck by, It's election day in the city of Chicago, where Mayor Lori Lightfoot is fighting to keep her job, and she could be in for a tough battle with eight other competitors vying for the position. Crime concerns have dominated that race, with all of the candidates putting an emphasis on public safety in their campaigns. Right now, there is no clear winner, which could mean a runoff in April, and big question as to whether or not Mayor Lightfoot makes the cut. Kellyanne Conway is a former counselor to President Trump. She is the president of KA Consulting and a Fox News contributor. Kellyanne, great to spend Tuesday afternoon with you. So, nine candidates in the race for Chicago mayor, according to a lot of people, really kind of solidifies the idea that there will be a runoff in April. But the big question, as we posited at the top, is will Mayor Lori Lightfoot be in that runoff? What do you think?
She may not. It's going to be the top two vote getters. Nobody's expected to crack 50%. And there's been Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot is set to become Chicago's first one-term mayor since 1983 after coming in third during yesterday's municipal elections in the Windy City, earning just 16.8% of the vote. Lightfoot is officially out of the race. Her challengers, former Chicago Public Schools CEO Paul Vallis and Cook County Commissioner Brandon Johnson, will head to a runoff in April. The mayor conceded in front of supporters last night. Let's watch.
Obviously, we didn't win the election today, but I stand here with my head held high and a heart full of gratitude. I am grateful to the millions of Chicagoans who came together as we made tough decisions, saw the struggles of our frontline workers, and beat back a deadly pandemic. I'm grateful that we worked together to remove a record number of guns off our streets, reduce homicides, and started making real progress on public safety.
Now, the race was absolutely dominated by the topics of crime and policing, with Lightfoot's opponents posturing themselves as tougher on crime than the mayor. Paul Vallis, who received over 30% of yesterday's vote, tweeted last month, quote, "Crime is out of control and new leadership will make our city safer. That's why I'm running for mayor." Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene had just this to say about Lightfoot's loss, quote, "Crime doesn't pay." So we will have a new mayor. So it's a runoff. So there'll be a new mayor regardless. She's out of the running. It's between these other two who both ran much tougher on crime campaigns. Crime does appear to be up in Chicago. I just checked the – let's see where it is here. The city's police budget ballooned 17% from 2019 to a record $1.9 billion in 2023, but at the same time, crime incidents jumped 41%.
Yeah, that seems to be the story. You know, this is not a tale about some progressive left-leaning mayor who cut police budgets and consequently saw crime go up and then got kicked out of her office.
progressives were jubilantly celebrating Lori Lightfoot leaving office precisely because she has done what tough on crime advocates wanted her to do. She's presided over this period, as you just mentioned, of increased police funding, and it hasn't actually made the lives of people in Chicago any better. It does have high crime rates. So the question is whomever comes in and fills her position going to do more of the same, or is there going to be some interrogation into actually what effectively lowers crime?
Yeah, I mean, she's in one of those positions where she has pleased no one. She is not perceived as being tough enough on crime, and crime is in fact up, but she is also not a progressive who has been for defunding the police or something like that. She's not pleased me, libertarian. She's on actually the one thing she was militantly like pro-police on was policing COVID infractions. She gave this, actually, I think we had this clip. Can you bring up that press conference where she laid into like teens who are daring to attend illicit parties during COVID? Can we play that?
Now, I've directed Superintendent Brown to order all police districts to give special attention to these parties. And this is how it's going to be. We will shut you down. We will cite you. And if we need to, we will arrest you and we will take you to jail, period. There should be nothing unambiguous about that. Don't make us treat you like a criminal. But if you act like a criminal and you violate the law and you refuse to do what is necessary to save lives in the city in the middle of a pandemic, we will take you to jail, period.
She wasn't talking about gangs there. She was talking about people who wanted social contact during the pandemic. So from my standpoint, good riddance.
Yeah, and that's nuts.
That's all I need. I'm a single issue voter there.
In a country with a mass incarceration problem and a city with as many problems as Chicago has, and for that to be your focus is absolutely nuts. And look, a lot of conservatives have also been dinging her for deflecting with stunts like this and by leaning in on certain identity issues, talking about being a black woman. And
she said in several interviews this week that this is why she lost literally yesterday, but she said before that, well, it's because I'm a black woman and they don't want a black woman in a leadership role.
They elected her in the first place, obviously. Yeah. And now there's an interesting question of whether or not Johnson, who's black, Brandon Johnson, is going to be able to kind of consolidate the black vote around him. It's a predominantly black city. And in this first election, obviously, to the extent that there is a black vote, it was divided between Lori Lightfoot, Johnson, and I think there were some smaller other candidates who got a much smaller share of the vote. What happens going forward, it'll be interesting. So Johnson seems to be positioned as the person who's, it's the framing of less tough on crime, more tough on crime is a little bit meaningless. But I would say that Vallis has openly courted some of the more draconian, I would argue, police. There's a police chief who apparently was complimentary of, seemed to endorse 1/6 in the insurrection, and Vallis was getting dinged or criticized for accepting his endorsement and kind of butting up with that guy. Johnson has never used the word defund and has stayed away from being associated with the more activist parts of police reform.
If you endorse 1/6, does that make you tough on cops in the tough on crime or tough on cops? The framing is so difficult
it's
here.
It's unclear. This is definitely one to watch. According to new reporting in The Hill, Republicans nationwide are retooling their message on crime after failing to fully tap into the issue during midterms. One GOP strategist told The Hill, quote, Lee Zeldin ran a one-issue campaign on the issue of crime. Every day he was at a metro stop or a corner store where somebody got shot or mugged. It's the clearest and easiest way for Republicans to tag Democrats to the fringe of the party.
It wasn't enough, but he did pretty well. He probably had some down ballot successes because of the campaign that he ran, and he got close. I would say it's not always going to be enough, but clearly some aspect of the Republican message on this is resonating with people who
rather 2020 the reaction to an emotionally charged House hearing about fentanyl and the ongoing border crisis. Rebecca Kiesling, who joined Harris in the Faulkner Focus this last hour, lost both of her sons, Caleb and Kyler, to fentanyl poisoning back in 2020. In heartbreaking testimony, she explained that the pain pills they took were laced with fentanyl that came across the southern border. And she tore into lawmakers for not doing enough to stop that.
You talk about children being taken away from their parents. My children were taken away from me. 100,000 Americans every year are having their children, 200,000 because it's both parents, right, are having their children taken away from them. This should not be politicized. It's not about race. Fentanyl doesn't care about race. You see, you talk about welcoming those crossing our border, seeking protection. You're welcoming drug dealers across our border. You're giving them protection. You're not protecting our children.
It shouldn't have been politicized, but it was. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene posted part of this distraught mother's testimony, and she tweeted, "Our government is failing our young people. Thousands are murdered by Chinese-made cartel-smuggled fentanyl each month, and Joe Biden is doing nothing to stop it. My heart breaks for this poor mother." And here's how the president responded.
Isn't she amazing? Oof. She was very specific recently, saying that a mom, a poor mother who lost two kids to fentanyl, that I killed her sons. The interesting thing is that fentanyl they took came during the last administration. Anyway, I don't want to get started.
The audience of Democrats did not laugh with him. Kiesling says she was shocked by his response and is now demanding an apology. Here she is last hour on the Faulkner Focus.
How can he sit there and joke about it? You know, he thought he was with a room full of Democrats and, you know, he's amongst friends and they can all yuck it up. What kind of a person does that?
Wow. You know, Harris, that was such an emotional interview. And our president started by saying, I probably shouldn't address this. He probably should have listened to that internal voice.
Yeah. You know, when she laid out that story and there were three victims the night that her sons died taking painkiller Percocet, the drug dealer was able to be revived by Narcan. Mm. But the young 17-year-old Sophie Harris, who was with him, also lost her life. And what Rebecca said so eloquently that maybe the president didn't hear and needs to hear over and over again, this is happening to unseen people because unless it's a cluster like this, it doesn't really get reported on. She made that very clear. And I think that's important for people to know. She's giving a voice now to literally hundreds of thousands of family members and friends and teachers and people who love these young people in their lives who are missing them today. I don't know why he would focus on the politics of the moment. It's always Trump's fault. It's amazing. And it's disgusting because it caused him to then disconnect with what we were all seeing as a human moment from a grieving mom and reconnect with politics. I mean, it was, well, is he the world's only heart donor is what went through my mind. It's heartbreaking to see the president of the United States react to tragedy that way. Consoler in chief, where are you?
Yeah, and yet there are many moms just like Rebecca that we watch, Douglas. In fact, last year we have the data, we'll pop it up, 100,000 overdose deaths, and about two-thirds of those were fentanyl. This is the first time in our history that we've seen that number broached. And when you look at CBP data, you can kind of toggle with data on Customs and Border Patrol. When you put in fentanyl in Southwest Border, we have it, we'll pop it up, you see 2020 fentanyl overdose go up, or fentanyl seizures rather, 2021 higher, 2022 you see. So more fentanyl crossing our border and being seized.
And I mean, we see the stories every day in the city we're sitting in. People seem to think that fentanyl is this sort of problem of, you know, flyover country or someone else's problem or a state that they don't visit very much, all this sort of thing. They always think they don't realize that it's people just like them who are losing family members. It's not just homeless people in New York or something like this. It's people across every strata of society, including in this city. Now, young professionals in this city who have been overdosing because of fentanyl in recent weeks. In recent weeks, we see cases of this. And as you say, because it's, unless it's a cluster case, it just washes through. Now, this is, you know, we often talk about crises in this country, and this is a real crisis. And it is tragic to see the president react like this. It's tragic to see that smirk on his face as if, I've got off this blame because this is a Trump thing. This isn't a Trump thing, it's not a Biden thing, it's an American thing that we have to address in this country.
And it's gotten worse and worse. In fact, Lisa, I want you to take a listen to the DEA administrator. Here's what she had to say. She said she's seen nothing like this before.
What we see happening at DEA is essentially that there are two cartels in Mexico, the Sinaloa cartel and the Jalisco New Generation cartel, that are killing Americans with fentanyl at catastrophic and record rates like we have never seen before.
Unprecedented, Lisa.
Well, Harris, first of all, that interview did, I could feel your emotion and see the emotion. I can't, you did a beautiful job with that. That must have been heart-wrenching. You know, regarding what we just heard, you know, look, for the Biden administration to fully address this crisis would also be an admission of guilt, that their border policies are failing and allowing this crisis to take place in America. But I want to say something about him, the callousness of laughing at her. I really think that's who Joe Biden is. He is deemed a consoler in chief, but only because he has suffered so much loss. And sadly, he has used that loss as a sword and a shield throughout his political career when, you know, inevitably he is a prolific liar. And has engaged in this type of behavior repeatedly throughout his career.
Hey, everyone. I'm Emily Campagno. Catch me and my co-host, Harris Faulkner.
Joe Biden sounding tone deaf about America's fentanyl crisis. The president trying to defend himself after a Republican congresswoman wrongly blamed him for a mother losing her two sons to the deadly drug. That mom gave heartbreaking testimony this week and begged the administration to take action. But instead of Biden being empathetic, the president was more concerned than the congresswoman got one of her facts wrong.
Isn't she amazing? Oof. She was very specific recently saying that a mom, a poor mother who lost two kids to fentanyl, that I killed her sons. The interesting thing is that fentanyl they took came during the last administration. Anyway, I don't want to get started.
Keep this in mind. Biden gave a half-hour speech, and that was the only mention of fentanyl or the border. The grieving mother of those boys not taking his carefree comment lightly.
What a horrible human being. How can he sit there and joke about it? Somebody asked me, did he just, like, misspeak? I'm like, this shows his heart. You don't have to think about what you say in a moment like this. And to me, it's like it shows this is why he just opened the border so wide. He just doesn't care. He's completely heartless. The president owes me an apology. And all of the other parents who have lost their children, he owes us an apology.
The White House trying to clean up Biden's remarks.
The American people knows who he is fundamentally because he's been around for some time, and they have watched him go through grief. He expressed sympathy for her last night, and his heart goes out to any person who has to go through that type of trauma. His words are being mischaracterized.
All right. Dana, the president's brand, at least what they say it is about empathy.
Empathy, yeah.
But it's time after time after time, from the border to fentanyl to East Palestine, he's not shown what his brand is. I'm beginning to believe the whole thing was just phony.
Dana, I feel for her, the mother. In fact, when we saw her at the testimony, it's a very difficult thing to do. And many of these moms who have lost children to fentanyl poisonings are the ones who are starting nonprofits in their communities or figuring out a way to connect with other moms. And basically they have this grief connection going on all across the country. And it is heartbreaking. She lost two of her sons. Okay. Now at the beginning of that clip, when Biden is talking about, isn't she something, he's referring to Marjorie Taylor Greene. So I think that it could be taken a little bit out of context, and that when it seems to be mocking her when he was talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene. When he talks about the mother, he is not empathetic. And what I wrote down here is his empathy instincts are not firing.
No.
And it is true that he has asked for empathy or leaned on empathy in his own case, right? Think about Hunter.
Yeah.
We talk about it a lot. Like that, any parent who is dealing with a child who has drug addiction problems and is trying to overcome them, you have to feel for them because what they go through is absolute hell. And that's what this woman's gone through. The thing that's surprising about not even mentioning fentanyl anywhere else in the speech or understanding it is that it seems like another one of these slow rolling things where they're going to all of a sudden realize that, wow, they are too slow to get to it. And they're going to look back and go, wow, how did we miss it? I don't know how they miss it. We're talking about it all the time. It's like the baby formula problem, the border problems, the crime problems. Because it's covered here, they don't want to talk about it. I don't know why. I don't know where Susan Rice is. She's the head of the Domestic Policy Council. Where's the plan? Is there any plan? What about the cabinet? Why can't you just call a cabinet meeting once in a while? That's why they're there and say, I want each of you to come up with two things that you can do to implement to make sure that we're protecting the children. Where are the ads? Why can't we do some public service announcements? Something like that. Trying to let kids know one pill can kill. The parents are asking for help, and they are not getting it at this time. We're going to talk a little bit later about the second gentleman, Kamala Harris's husband, looking for a cause. This one's staring him right in the face. The one he chose is pitiful, but we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah. Greg Gutfeld.
Yeah. We've been talking about this. We've been talking about opioids legally, illegally, otherwise for years. And I'm pretty sure it was here. I know I wrote about it. I predicted that the crackdown on legal opioids would lead to a mountain of dead because you're not doing anything about the demand. You're just replacing a safe and legal low-dose supply with a street drug of unknown potency that's often deadly. So that's definitely going to kill more people. It's not Joe Biden's. It's everybody. It's Obama. It's Trump. It's Biden. Because we've been talking about this for years. No one was actually ever engaged on it. And it may be the Fox contamination effect or the five contamination effect. Anything we talk about because we picked a side, they can't be on that side. So Marjorie Taylor Greene, they're both wrong. Okay. She says that Biden basically has blood on his hands. He doesn't. That's probably polygrip. But she learned from the best, right? Where did she get that vernacular, right? Where does the new right get the vernacular? From the old left, right? The Dems have mastered the blood on your hands screech from talking to pro-life, going after pro-lifers to capitalists, to law enforcement, to parents fighting, you know, to protect their kids from, you know, trans activism ideology. You can blame both parties for inaction. But this problem's been around for a while, and at least MTG is showing some passion about it. Now, Joe is wrong, right? He's using an example, although correct, it involves casualties. Like when you're in a debate, it doesn't look good to say, don't blame me for those dead kids. That's on the other guy. Right. What with the mother recently and freshly there grieving, and he couldn't resist it. He couldn't. Mm-hmm. Own, in this case, he couldn't own the righty, you know, and so he was prepared for it, actually. He had this thing. So they're both in the law. This is a tough topic because it's so weird. Does this help stop the flow of illegal fentanyl? That's the question everybody should ask. Apparently, it gets people to pay attention when there is this kind of conflict. Maybe they'll understand the topic more and consider ending it. Maybe we will go in and we'll bomb these places. On the surface level, this feels like people trying to get at each other when really they should be cooperating on killing this enemy.
Apparently it's not bringing us together, Judge Jeanine.
You know, I have a bit of a different take. This is the president of the United States. It's not about Marjorie Taylor Greene. Oof, I get that. Everybody can laugh about that. What it's about is a woman who lost two sons, who feels that she's owed an apology. We've got an administration right now with a guy who's a fool and he's clueless. And I am dead serious about that. There are Americans dying every year, more now than have died in world wars. And he can't even get the word fentanyl off his lips. And when you need a press secretary of the United States to tell the American people that the president is really, everybody knows how pathetic he is and how empathic he is, we're in a real problem. America is starting to understand the man who hid in the basement in that Trojan horse doesn't care about you if you're from East Palestine, if you're an American in Afghanistan, if you're a mother who lost two sons through no fault of her own. He's going to say something and laugh about it and blame it on another guy. That is such the instinct of the left. Blame it on the other guy when his own attorney general is admitting that fentanyl is unleashed on purpose in the United States. And all we need to do is do something in Mexico, force the president of Mexico the way Trump did when he was trying to get them to control the border from the illegals.
He said, I'm going to put tariffs on it. And there was some control. Right now, I'm not interested in people saying, well, it could have meant this, or maybe he wasn't empathic enough. That is disgusting. What he did showed the real true heart that he has.
Yeah, not a classy move by the president here.
I don't think I would necessarily say it wasn't a classy move. It was obviously improperly handled, that it gave anyone the impression that he doesn't care about the fact that a woman lost her son to fentanyl. And I would add to what Dana said, he has a son who struggles with drug addiction, and he also has a son who died of cancer that he talks about quite regularly. Someone who, you know, served our country, died a terrible death, and that's something that he uses to connect with people, and that was missing from this. But his frustration with Marjorie Taylor Greene and the lies that are being told about his record on this, I think are worthwhile elevating and discussing. So I was watching something this weekend that had the moment where Joe Wilson, the congressman from South Carolina, said, you lie at Barack Obama during the State of the Union. It was something about Obamacare. And it was like the world was exploding because the congressman dared do that. And John Boehner, who was the leader of the Republicans, made him apologize, called and apologized. And Obama said, no problem, you know, moving on. And then you look at the last State of the Union, where Marjorie Taylor Greene is standing up and howling at him, essentially. I mean, the pictures from it and the sounds, we all watched it. We have so devolved in the way that we treat one another that it allows you to, well, it allows someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene to think it's okay to rampantly lie about someone. It does matter when someone died. It matters that we've had a fentanyl crisis for years. Greg's right about that. But saying, because this happened, Joe Biden is guilty of that. You should know that it happened during 2020 when Trump was president. You can say we have more deaths now, fentanyl deaths, than we did that year. But also we have more apprehensions of fentanyl at the border by astronomical amounts. And that's what this has turned into. There's a new ad out by a liberal group that's thanking Joe Biden for how serious he is about the border because Marjorie Taylor Greene stepped in it. And she said 4,800 pounds of fentanyl confiscated by CPB in 2020, 11,200 pounds in Biden's first year. And that's what you get. You just get more partisan bickering about it because that's what everyone does.
Which you're saying seizing more fentanyl than they did last year is actually a good thing? That's like saying we encountered more illegals at the border than we did last year.
Well, it's because it's about apprehensions and it's about confiscations. Now, I know how many deaths there are. I know that those numbers continue to go up. I'm just trying to frame the way that partisans think about this. And that's why these issues that are human issues so rarely get dealt with because everyone just goes to their corners.
Look, this is a mother who lost two sons. This is about a man who's laughing about it. And I'm not talking about the first part of the statement. I'm talking about the second part. He has no empathy. She thinks he needs her, that he owes her an apology.
Then you know what? He should give her that apology. I think that that would be great.
I think that would be the only way he gets himself out of this.
But I'm going to be bold with it, that nobody who is a Joe Biden supporter thinks that he doesn't care about that mother. And everyone who hates Joe Biden thinks what you think.
She doesn't think it.
I sincerely doubt that that woman
voted
for Joe Biden.
We want a little bit more than caring. We want to see him in action. Just saying you care isn't enough anymore.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to click to subscribe to the Fox News YouTube page. This is the only way that I know.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson. Tonight there is a verdict in that very depressing but also Byzantine and interesting murder trial with Judge Jeanine in a moment to take us through exactly what happened and what happens next. But first, you always imagine in your mind's eye that it's evil men who destroy society, wild-eyed, spit-flecked dictators pounding the podium to demand the annihilation of their enemies. That's the Hollywood version of it. But in real life, people like that rarely get very far. They're too obvious. It's not the cartoon demons you've got to worry about. It's weak men in positions of power. They're the most dangerous. Men with no principles but the desire for self-preservation. Hollow men who live in terror of being revealed for who they really are. Men who will do anything to save themselves. That's who you should be afraid of. And you can see that in our current moment. The weakest are the most destructive. How much of his childhood do you think Adam Kinzinger spent hanging from the wedgie nail? How many swirlies did Eric Swalwell endure in high school?
How old was Adam Schiff before a girl other than his sister kissed him voluntarily? It makes you shudder to think about it. These are sad, insecure, broken men filled with envy and bitterness from their lonely childhoods. They hate you because they hate themselves. It's not their masculinity that's toxic. It's their lack of it. That's really the story of the Biden administration. The weakest president in history joined forces with the weakest attorney general in history to create a police state. Shocking? Well, once you understand the principle, it shouldn't really surprise you. And it's funny now to remember the smart people in Washington once told us that Merrick Garland was a moderate. They thought that apparently because when Garland's promised Supreme Court seat didn't materialize, he cried. Oh, he's crying, they thought. He's so sensitive and thoughtful. But no, Merrick Garland was crying for himself because he is a self-pitying careerist with no perspectives on his own life, whose job is everything to him. He is, in other words, literally the last person you would ever put in charge of the Department of Justice. So naturally, Joe Biden did. And that turned out to be a pivotal decision. Merrick Garland has presided over the most aggressive attack on civil liberties, and in particular, an attack on the practice of traditional Christianity that any living American has seen. Now, Garland would never say that in public, of course. That would be too straightforward. His approach is feline, not canine. Every word is a weasel word. But under sustained questioning, the real Merrick Garland emerges, and it is filthy and dishonest. Here he was in the Senate yesterday facing off against Mike Lee of Utah.
DOJ has announced charges against 34 individuals for blocking access to or vandalizing abortion clinics. And there have been over 81 reported attacks on pregnancy centers, 130 attacks on Catholic churches since the leak of the Dobbs decision, and only two individuals have been charged. So how do you explain this disparity?
We apply the law equally. I will say you are quite right. There are many more prosecutions with respect to the blocking of the of the abortion centers. But that is generally because they are those actions are taken in, with photography at the time during the daylight, and seeing the person who did it is quite easy. Those who are attacking the pregnancy resources centers, which is a horrid thing to do, are doing this at night in the dark.
Okay. In case you didn't follow that, we, quote, apply the law equally. We just can't for some reason manage to investigate crimes that occur after dark. It's the sundown rule, well known in legal circles. It's hard to believe that Merrick Garland actually said that in a Senate hearing until you remember that, of course, he will say anything, and he does. We're not persecuting Christians, he'll tell you. Then he'll send the FBI after Mark Houck. Houck is a pro-life lay preacher who was praying outside an abortion clinic when a pro-abortion extremist harassed his 12-year-old son. So as any father would, Houck shoved the man out of his son's face. That's what happened. It was not a crime. We know that because no local prosecutor pursued it. And it is certainly, without question, not a federal felony to push a lunatic out of your 12-year-old son's face. But under Merrick Garland, it is now a felony. Almost a year after that happened, Garland sent armed men to arrest Mark Houck in front of his family.
On September 23rd, about 6:45 in the morning, that's when those 20 so-called agents, full SWAT gear, heavily armored vests, ballistic shields, helmets, battering ram, banged on my door.
Yesterday, Josh Hawley asked Garland to explain that behavior, the utterly indefensible totalitarian behavior. And Merrick Garland, of course, in his soft-spoken way, was delighted to defend it.
Let's take a look at the hardened criminals that your Justice Department sent these armed agents to go terrorize on that morning. Here they are. Here they are at mass. Here's the seven children with Mr. Houck and his wife. He has offered to turn himself in. And this is who you go to terrorize. You are the Attorney General. Give me your answer. Do you think that it was objectively reasonable and they followed your guidelines in sending 20 to 30 armed agents to terrorize these people? Yes or no?
The facts I have, which are those presented by the FBI, are not consistent with your description.
So you think it was reasonable?
I'm saying the facts are not as you describe.
You use an unbelievable show of force with guns that I just note liberals usually decry. We're supposed to hate long guns and assault-style weapons. You're happy to deploy them against Catholics and innocent children.
He doesn't care. He's got no soul, obviously. And if anything, Josh Hawley's description is too narrow. It's not just Catholics that Merrick Garland has targeted with force. It's anybody who expresses a belief in biblical Christianity in public. But it is true that Catholics do seem to be getting a disproportionate share of federal law enforcement attention under Joe Biden. The FBI, as you may know, just drafted a memo claiming that radical traditional Catholics are somehow a national security threat, presumably because they tend to pray outside of abortion clinics. In March of 2021, Paul Vaughn and 10 others were peacefully praying at an abortion clinic in Tennessee. They didn't damage any property. They hurt no one. More than a year after they dared to do that, to pray, Merrick Garland sent the FBI to terrorize Vaughn and his 11 children at their home.
But if you're not going to let me, then I'll just...
No, I want to know why you were banging on my door with a gun.
Hey, let's get up to it.
You're not going to tell me anything?
No, we're not.
I tried.
And no, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
You did not try.
You have to wonder when you see a tape like that, where are so-called Christian leaders? Where's Russell Moore and all the other breastfeeding Christians as that happens, as the U.S. government cracks down on Christianity, on prayer? Silent. Paul Vaughn and his co-conspirators now face more than a decade in prison. Meanwhile, just in case you want to know what the scale is for punishment, the Department of Justice under Joe Biden let half the rioters go who tried to torch a courthouse in Oregon. No charges whatsoever. Of 99 cases that the Portland U.S. Attorney brought over that courthouse siege for crimes like assaulting federal officers and civil disorder, more than 47 were dropped by DOJ. The most serious penalties for most of the defendants who pleaded guilty turned out to be community service. So the DOJ under Merrick Garland absolves Joe Biden voters of actual terrorism while doing everything they can to terrify, humiliate, and destroy people who pray in public. They're targeting specifically anyone who is religious, humiliating them in front of their children. Why are they doing this? Well, because on some level, all governments hate religious people, because it's competition. And revolutionary governments, totalitarian governments, go after religious people first. It happened in the French Revolution, happened in the Bolshevik Revolution, and it's happening now. That's why parents who dare to complain about their children being sexually indoctrinated and openly sexualized are attacked, in some cases, by the DOJ. Again, you can see why. Young people raised to believe that God is in charge are much harder for the government to control as they grow up. They won't worship the government. But by contrast, if a child is raised to be a narcissist, someone who thinks, well, I can change my gender, he will grow up confused, weak, and reliant on the people in charge of the state. It's a very simple principle. It's why the Maoist government went after Tibetan monks. Anyone who sincerely believes in God is a threat. And that is the measure of a free country in the end. Are you allowed to believe that there's an authority higher than the people in charge of your government? That has always been the hallmark of America, religious liberty. It's in the First Amendment. But in Canada, of course, that's all disappeared. Canada has now become an atheist totalitarian state with amazing speed. And in Canada, it's now a crime to object to sexualized drag shows for children. You're not allowed to say a word. Late last month, a pastor in Calgary was violently thrown out of an all-ages, in other words, for children, drag queen story hour for daring to object to the sexualization of children. Watch this.
We are now calling the police. We have the police coming. So it is your choice to leave or deal with the police.
So that's the video. That's what happened. Who committed the violence in that video? The guy on the ground was the pastor. Before we answer the question, some context will remind you that in Canada, showing any disloyalty at all to the Trudeau government could get your bank account frozen and your truck seized. So maybe you're not surprised to learn that that man on the ground, whose name is Pastor Derek Reamer, who showed profound disrespect for Justin Trudeau's ongoing efforts to sexualize children and mutilate the genitals of children, woke up yesterday to the police banging on his door and telling him he was going to be arrested.
Why are you showing up in my home?
Because this is where you live, right?
Yeah, you guys could call me. We could.
Sorry, what's that?
You could have called me.
I've been trying to.
When?
Tomorrow. We need to talk about what happened on the weekend this evening, right?
Why do we need to talk about it?
Because you're going
to
be arrested for it and charged.
Okay.
So we can go deal with it this morning, or I can just put warrants out for you.
Charged with what?
Mischief and causing disturbance.
Where are all the professional Christians? You have to wonder that again. Where's David French and Beth Moore and Tim Keller and all these people who are defending Christianity as actual Christians are being arrested for being Christians? Not a word. Well, today, Pastor Derek Reamer confirmed that a warrant was out for his arrest for hate crimes, and he was right about that. He was not overstating it because this afternoon he was literally arrested. What?
Then I put down the arrest for a pending warrant. I'm assuming it's been...
Is there a reason you're blocking me from using the sidewalk?
Construction, they're working here.
I'm not going to obstruct them. Don't worry, I'm not going to run. I'm not worried about you. We're just going to stay out of the workspace. Do you mind if I ask you what he's being arrested for?
Are you going to provide your identification?
Pardon?
Will you provide your ID?
It's for you to answer the question.
Yeah.
Okay. Why is he being arrested?
He has warrants.
Warrants out for his arrest?
This is what happens when we go against the Drake.
Wow. That doesn't look like the Canada you thought you knew. All Molson and sled dogs or some stormtrooper in sunglasses won't answer a question before you provide your ID. And then the pastor sitting in a car with bars on the windows getting hauled away to jail for being thrown to the ground at Drag Queen Story Hour. We're going to be joined by Pastor Derek Reamer tonight, but he is, of course, in jail. So instead, we are grateful to be joined by Ezra Levant of Rebel News, which filmed the tape you just saw. Ezra, thank you so much for coming on. It's hard to believe that this is happening in your country. Meta question first, is anyone saying anything about it other than you?
Not a lot. I mean, Tucker, you have done more journalism on Christian pastors being jailed in Canada than most Canadian media. In fact, the Canadian media either ignore it or cheer it on, calling these people bigots. I should say that there were no charges emanating from the Drag Queen Story Hour itself, neither against Pastor Reamer or against the three men who roughed him up. But then the left-wing mayor of Calgary went on a Twitter rant saying that anyone who lies or engages in vitriol or is full of hate should be arrested and charged. Now, those aren't crimes, by the way. Some of them are a matter of opinion. I could think that the mayor's full of hate. But after the mayor basically directed police to arrest peaceful protesters, they did. And you saw that cop. I think he was embarrassed and ashamed of what he was doing. He had sunglasses on. He was blocking our cameraman. He had that bizarre move, show me your ID before I answer a question. I think he knows that he is doing something contrary to his oath as a police officer. Right now, we have a reporter staked out at the city jail because, Tucker, I don't... Of course, he was the one who was disturbed by the roughing up. It'll be interesting to see if he gets out on bail or, like Arthur Pavlovsky, the other Christian pastor, if he'll serve 50 days in prison, which is what happened then.
I say this as one of the few Americans I know really who sincerely loves Canada, and I mean that. But it does seem like darkness is descending on your country.
I have to say, just a few weeks ago, Justin Trudeau's martial law, where he seized bank accounts and deployed riot horses because some people were honking their horns in their trucks and having a festive, peaceful opposition to the lockdowns. A judge had a lengthy inquiry, and he said, thumbs up, that there was a justification for martial law. And so I'm telling you, Tucker, the checks and balances in Canada no longer work. The opposition parties often don't oppose. The media cheerleads. It's not skeptical or critical. The courts are of no use. Not a single lockdown law was overturned. Our so-called Charter of Rights and Freedoms has not struck down a single action like this. And I'm starting to think that we might need help from abroad. And so I'd say to your audience, I know you have senators and congressmen who care about civil rights and human rights in China and Iran and places like that. And I would say, please, cast an eye up to Canada, too, because I'm worried that we no longer have the capacity to push back for human rights. And Canadian politicians are very attentive when Americans criticize or mention them. Please, American senators and congressmen, put us on your watch list. Things are getting bad up here.
And for context, for those who don't know, I mean, you do run the biggest dissident media organization in the country. So you speak with authority. Ezra, we are definitely rooting for you, and God bless and good luck. Thank you.
Thank you.
So teachers in this country losing their jobs for trying to protect their children from efforts to sexualize them. In the Drupa School District in California, teachers are prohibited from telling parents when their children are, quote, transitioning to another gender. So your kid could be getting castrated or chemically or physically, and you're not allowed to know that. Jessica Tapias teaches in that district. She refused to comply with the policy. She said it violated her Christian beliefs as well as her basic responsibilities as a teacher. So she was fired for that. She's brave enough to join us now along with her attorney, Brad Dacus. Thank you both very much for coming on. Jessica, first to you, I assume the other teachers in your district complied with this grotesque order. Why did you not?
Great question, Tucker. I'm truly afraid that many other teachers don't even know they're under these directives. I didn't know I was under these directives until I found out. And when I found out from my school district that I was under these directives, I chose to speak up about them and stand my ground and stand in my faith and beliefs. And that's when they said, that's going to be an issue. You have to comply with these directives or your job is on the line. And so I chose God. I chose to stick with my Christian faith. And because of that, they released me from employment because in their words, they could not accommodate my religious beliefs.
But I mean, you were also, and bless you for doing that, and you should do that, but you were also siding with parents, all of whom, no matter who they voted for in the last election, you'd think would want to know if their children are being castrated, like their children. Don't you think parents want to know?
Yes, I think parents have the right to know everything about their children, and I will not partake in withholding any information from a parent. I'm a parent myself, and I would be very upset about that. So this fight is not just for the sake of my job loss. This fight is for the protection of all children. This fight is for the preservation of parental rights.
Well, amen. But Brad, is this, since you're the attorney here, is it legal to fire someone for refusing to hide essential facts from parents who are the guardians of these children?
Yeah, this is a clear breach of public trust, and it's a clear violation of her Title VII rights. She was fired not because of the job she did, Tucker. She was fired because of her religious beliefs. And mind you, she's not alone. We at Pacific Justice Institute, we're representing hundreds of people, employees who are fired because of their faith. And the issue is also one of the parents. They're scared, Tucker, right now. They see all of what's going on. They're horrified by it. And it's for that reason, on our website, we've developed customized opt-out forms for all 50 states, where parents for free can download opt-out forms, start learning what their rights are, as well as the material that's being given to the kids and their grandparents.
And I know the answer I want to hear. Were there teachers you work with who came up to you and congratulated you for your bravery, I hope?
You know, Tucker, I'm being totally overwhelmed in the best way possible with hundreds of teachers reaching out to me, telling me that they're ready to die on this hill with me, that they completely align with my views on this, that they are ready to stand up to this beast with me and stand for the protection of children and stand for parental rights and, you know, stand for the fact of the matter that as Christians, we can also be in the public sector. And at this point, I feel that I was told you need to choose one or the other. Do you want to be a public school teacher or do you want to continue practicing your Christian faith?
Well, good for you. We're always mean to teachers, but I married one. And I know there are a lot of wonderful teachers and you're obviously one of them. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Tucker.
So much.
Fox News alert on a case you may have been following, a verdict in the double murder trial of disbarred lawyer Alex Murdaugh. The trial attracted a lot of attention. The family is prominent in the state of South Carolina. There was a press conference moments ago. Here's part of it.
Justice was done today.
It doesn't matter who your family is. It doesn't matter how much money you have or people think you have. It doesn't matter how prominent you are. If you do wrong, if you break the law, if you murder, then justice will be done in South Carolina. And I think South Carolina has shown to the nation and the world how a process can work and work well.
Fox's Trace Gallagher is rooted in this trial. He's been following it for 6 weeks since the beginning. He joins us tonight for a recap. Hey, Trace.
And Tucker, it's about as fast a verdict as I've ever seen. The jury of 8 women and 4 men deliberated for just under 3 hours. And usually when you have 76 witnesses, it takes several hours just to review the testimony. So a quick verdict is often beneficial to the defendant, but not this time. And remember, Alec Murdaugh's defense was basically, yes, I'm a liar. Yes, I'm a crook, a drug addict, but I'm not a killer. Most attorneys we spoke with during the trial say Alec Murdaugh's biggest hurdle was cell phone video, where you could hear Alec Murdaugh's voice proving that he was in the kennel, that's the scene of the crime, just moments before the killings happened. Murdaugh told investigators that he was not in the kennel, but after being caught red-handed on tape, he later testified that he lied about not being in the kennel because his drug habit had left him paranoid. Murdaugh wanted the jury to believe he left the kennel, went to his house, did not hear any gunshots, returned to the kennel, and found the bodies of his wife and son. He also testified that he held their bodies, despite having no blood evidence on his clothing. It's notable the murder weapons were never found in this case, so it was impossible to connect Murdaugh to any of the weapons. And there was little, if any, forensic evidence implicating Murdaugh. But the circumstantial evidence, as you heard, was robust. In fact, the lead prosecutor moments ago in that news conference that's now over says they knew if they had a chance to put on their case that truth would prevail. And it's important to remember Alec Murdaugh testified in his own defense. Most analysts thought he was a very effective witness. The jury clearly did not share.
Amazing. Very sad story. Trish Gallagher, thank you for that.
Yep.
So as you just heard, prosecutors did hold a press conference very recently. One prosecutor spoke about the victims in this crime. Here's part of it.
Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government except for every other kind. I kind of want to adopt that and say we may have the worst criminal justice system in the world, but it's better than every other kind that there is. And our criminal justice system worked tonight. It gave a voice to Maggie and Paul Murdaugh, who were brutally mowed down and murdered on the night of June 7th, 2021 by someone that they loved and someone that they trusted. And they couldn't be here to testify for themselves tonight. Their testimony came through the evidence and the information that was gathered by the men and women of the agencies I just mentioned. It came from the testimony of the agents and the investigators and the attorneys and the folks in our staff who were able to get it to the court record. And so I want to say tonight, their voice was heard tonight and justice was brought for them. We can't bring them back, but we can bring them justice.
Judge Jean Pirro is co-host of The Five, has also been following this case, and we're happy to have her join us tonight. Judge, thanks so much for coming on. What's your takeaway from this very, very sad and ugly saga?
Well, I followed this case from the beginning. There were something like 28 days of testimony. It was a span of about 6 weeks. Incredibly fast verdict, especially in a case that's circumstantial. But all murder cases, essentially, because the victim isn't going to come back and say, you know, he killed me, or unless there's a video or an eyewitness, they are all circumstantial. This family was from one of the wealthiest, most successful, legendary family in that county in South Carolina. This defendant was arrogant enough to think that he could take the stand and convince the jury that, yes, I took pills and I was a drug addict and I stole from people, a quadriplegic and young women and my housekeeper and all that other stuff, but I didn't kill my wife and son. And okay, maybe you can buy that. But the problem is that he lied until he was mandated to admit as a result of a Snapchat video that was released not that long ago that had his voice at the scene of the crime within minutes of the crime. And it was curious. this to me, why, Tucker, the defense wanted to take the jury to the scene of the crime. If anything, by the defense taking the jury there, they were able to assess how far the house was, where the defendant said, I was taking a nap, is sleeping, and I didn't hear any gunshot wounds, to the distance at the kennels where you would have heard the gunshot wounds. So that was kind of bizarre, but I think his taking the stand was bizarre. Everyone agreed he was a good witness, but he was too slick because in the end, the jury bought none of this. The judge did not even offer the jury dinner. He said, you've got beverages, soda, chips, and, you know, cookies or whatever. The judge eventually said there was an overwhelming evidence of guilt here after the jury returned the verdict.
May I ask you a question? You said he was slick. He was very good as a witness. This guy's an ambulance chaser, right? Isn't he a slip and fall lawyer? Who's
he
used
is
to argue
an excellent
cases?
Attorney. And that's what people.
Well, I meant that
about.
As an insult.
Yeah.
Sorry.
He was an attorney with a huge law firm that made a lot of money. He made a lot of money. He spent a lot of it on drugs and just stealing. He just kept stealing to the next level. But this case came down, Tucker, to the classic motive means an opportunity. The shell casings, although they never found the guns, were consistent on the property, a 1,700-acre property, as the shell casings from the weapon that killed Maggie, the wife. And the kind of gun that was used was his favorite kind of gun. So what you had here was a guy who had a wife who was speaking to a matrimonial attorney, a son that he called a little detective, very important. He said, we have to talk to you about the pills. They were coming on to him strong that he was using opioids. And then we hear that at the scene of the crime, the dogs are not barking. So at the time, within minutes of the crime, there's nobody who's coming around as a stranger cropping up on them and shooting the wife and son. This is a classic domestic violence case.
Wait, but can I ask, is this, you've been in the law a long time. Is this common behavior for personal injury attorneys? Not to generalize, but would you say?
Oh, well, I don't know any personal injury attorneys who killed somebody. But,
okay.
You know, what I do know is that they're theatrical. To them, mm-hmm. The courtroom is theater. And this guy thought he controlled the theater. And my understanding is that Harpulian, it is very well respected and regarded defense attorney, didn't want him to take the stand. But the defendant makes the ultimate decision himself. The saddest part of this is that this is your classic domestic violence case. Husband kills his wife and his son, thinks that everybody is going to buy this, you know, oh, poor me. And in the end, they saw him for what he was. A drug addicted, thieving, conniving, lying, now a double murderer.
Your analysis of it. Thank you.
You're
Judge
welcome.
Jeanine Pirro, okay. The best. Thank you. Remember the shop teacher who brought the whole shop class into a sexual fetish with the cartoonishly large fake breasts?
Night.
The state versus Richard Alexander Murdoch, defendant, indictment for murder, guilty verdict. The state of South Carolina, county of Colleton, in the court of general sessions, the July term of 2022. The state versus Richard Alexander Murdoch, defendant, indictment for murder, verdict, guilty.
Now, that was the moment reality set in for Alex Murdoch, the smooth-talking scion of an elite South Carolina family, found guilty on all counts in the murder trial of his wife and son. A panel of 12 jurors returned a guilty verdict after fewer than 3 hours of deliberations, and it was so quick, in fact, the judge didn't even offer him dinner. Now, according to reporters in the room, his only living son, Buster, sat in the gallery, shaking his head in disbelief, but he did not appear to shed a tear. Now, the trial really took that turn after the jury saw a key piece of evidence. It was a Snapchat video taken by Paul Murdoch at the dog kennels just minutes before he and Maggie were killed. Listen, you're going to hear three separate voices.
Hey, he's got a bird in his mouth.
Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
This is a chicken.
Come here, Bobcat.
Now, Alex Murdoch maintained for years that he was not there, but when witnesses said he was third voice, Murdoch finally admitted a lie. Here's why.
As my addiction evolved over time, I would get in these situations or circumstances where I would get paranoid thinking. It could be anything that triggered it once I told the lie. Then I told my family. I had to keep lying.
Now, the defense was hoping that a lack of physical evidence would help them in their case. To this day, investigators have not found the family-owned rifle that they say he used to kill his wife, nor have they found the shotgun used to kill his son, Paul. But the prosecution banked on none of that mattering. Like the lie of him being at the kennels, they sold the jury on Alex Murdoch's decades of deceit.
Everyone who thought they were close to him, everyone who thought they knew he was who he was, he's fooled them all. And he fooled Maggie and Paul, too. And they paid for it with their lives. Don't let him fool you, too.
That was a brilliant close, as we now know tonight. Joining us now, Mark E. Glark, who's a former prosecutor and criminal defense attorney, and Francis Hakes, former federal prosecutor. Mark, let's start with you. Were you surprised by how quickly the jury came back with this decision?
Yes, because all those things that we were calling reasonable doubts were merely questions. And to this day, they might not even know the answer to those questions. He does. How he was able to avoid getting blood all over him, or if he did, how he was able to clean it up, how he was able to clean up that crime scene. Those are just questions that we thought might give the jurors pause and may lead to reasonable doubt. But they saw through it. One thing that they didn't have any doubt over was his guilt. So we could take away allegedly. We now know what a monster looks like. It's unbelievable how cold and calculating this guy is. It's so disturbing, and he's right where he needs to be.
Now, Francie, the fact that he was really bawling on the stand, I mean, he was really conjuring up those tears. But a lot of people that you listened to talking about it were taken in by that. And I really believe that he thought emoting on the stand, it was risky, but that he could pick off one juror with his emotions. Am I reading that correctly?
You are, Laura. That's exactly what he thought. And that's